This is disc number 2.
Take me to the place where we had the fight, Richard ordered. Victor nodded. Easy enough. The man turned and started out toward the dark woods. Chapter 4. With two fingers, Nikki pushed a wet balsam bough out of her way as she followed several of the men through the dense woods. At the edge of a thickly forested ridge, they headed down a trail that switched back and forth in order to negotiate the steep descent. Slippery rocks made the climb down treacherous. It was a shorter route than the one they had used to carry Richard back to the deserted farmhouse after he'd been hurt. At the bottom, they picked their way over exposed fractured rock and boulders, skirting the fringe of a boggy area guarded by a towering cluster of silvered skeletons of cedars standing vigil in the stagnant water. Runnels pouring down mossy banks carved deep cuts through the forest loam to expose speckled granite beneath. Several days of steady rain had left standing ponds in a number of low places. For the most part, the rain filled the woods with the pleasing fragrance of damp soil, but in low places and crannies, the damp, decomposing vegetation smelled of rot. Even though she was warm from the short, arduous trek, the damp, cool air still left Nikki's fingers and ears numb with cold. She knew that this far south in the old world, the heat and humidity would soon return with such vengeance that it would make her long for the unusual spell of cool weather. Having grown up in the city, Nikki had spent little time outdoors. At the Palace of the Prophets, where she had lived most of her life, outdoors meant the manicured lawns and gardens of the grounds covering Hall's Band Island. The countryside had always seemed vaguely hostile to her, an obstacle between one city and another, something to be avoided. Cities and buildings were a refuge from the inscrutable dangers of the wilderness. More than that, though, cities had been where she toiled for the betterment of mankind. That work had had no end. Forests and fields had not been any of her concern. Nikki had never appreciated the beauty of hills, trees, streams, lakes, and mountains until she had come to know Richard. Even cities were new to her eyes after Richard. Richard made all of life a wonder. Carefully making her way up the slippery, dark rock of a brief rise, she finally spotted the rest of the men quietly waiting under the outstretched limbs of an ancient maple. Farther away, Richard crouched, studying a patch of ground. He finally rose to stare off into the dark expanse of woods beyond. Kara, his ever-present shadow, waited near him. Under the dense vault of soothing green, the moored Sith's red leather outfit stood out like a clot of blood on a tablecloth at tea. Nikki understood Kara's fierce and passionate protection of Richard. Kara, too, had once been his enemy. Richard had not simply gained Kara's blind allegiance by virtue of becoming the Lord Rahl. He had, far more importantly, earned her respect, trust, and loyalty. Her red leather outfit was intimidating by design, a promise of violence should anyone even think of causing him harm. It was not an empty promise. Mord Sith had been trained since they were young to be absolutely ruthless. While their primary purpose had been to capture the gifted and use their power against them, they were perfectly capable of using their ability against any opposition. Men who knew and trusted Kara without realizing they were doing it kept more distance from her when she wore her red leather. Nikki knew how it felt for Kara to be brought back from the numb madness of mindless duty, to come to again value life. Off in the distance, through the gloom and shadows and dripping leaves, the hoarse croak of ravens echoed through the forest. Nikki caught the sickening stench of rotting carrion. Looking around for landmarks, as Richard had taught her, she spotted at the base of a rocky outcropping a pine that she remembered because it had a secondary trunk that curved out low to the ground almost like a seat. She recognized the spot. Beyond the screen of vines and brush lay the scene of the battle. Before Nikki could get to Richard, he ducked under low-hanging branches and started into the underbrush. Rising up on the far side, he waved his arms over his head and yelled like a lunatic. The deep shade among towering spruce erupted from the flapping of wings, as all at once, hundreds of the huge black birds bounded into the air, shrieking with indignation at having their feast interrupted. At first it looked as if the birds might contest the field of battle, but when the air sang with the unique sound of Richard's sword being drawn, they fled into the darkness back among the trees almost as if they knew what a weapon was and feared this one in particular. Their deep, angry croaking receded into the hazy mist. Richard, the triumphant scarecrow, glowered after them for a time before sliding his sword back into its scabbard. He finally turned to the men. "All of you, please stay out of this area for now." His voice echoed off through the tall pines. "Just wait back there." Considering herself sovereign in matters of Richard's safety, Kara paid no heed to his request. Instead, she followed him as he made his way into the small clearing beyond, staying close but out of his way. Nikki wove her way among the saplings and wet ferns, moving past silent men until she reached a thin patch of white birch, topping a hillock that edged one side of the clearing. Hundreds of black eyes set in the white bark watched as she made her way among them to finally halt at the brow of the bank. When she rested her hand on the peeling papery bark of one, she noticed the bolt from a crossbow stuck in the tree. Arrows jutted from the other trees as well. Beyond, dead soldiers lay sprawled everywhere. The stench staggered her. The ravens had been driven off, but the flies, fearing no sword, remained to feast and breed. The first hatch of blowfly maggots were already hard at work. A good number of men were headless or were missing limbs. Some lay partly submerged in the stagnant pools of water. The ravens, along with other animals, had been at many of them, taking advantage of the opportunity afforded by gaping wounds. The thick leather armor, heavy hide, studded belts, chainmail, and wicked assortment of weapons no longer did these men any good. Here and there, the clothes around bloated bodies strained to remain buttoned, as if trying to maintain dignity where there could be none. Everything, from the men's flesh and bone to their fanatical beliefs, would lie here and rot in this forgotten patch of forest. Waiting in the trees, Nikki watched as Richard briefly inspected the corpses. That first morning, he'd already killed a great many of the soldiers before Victor and his men arrived and charged in to help him. She didn't know how long Richard had been fighting with that arrow in his chest, but it wasn't the kind of injury that anyone could endure for long. Huddled back under the partial shelter of the huge maple, the nearly 24 men pulled cloaks tight against the chill and settled in to wait. Everywhere in the hushed forest, boughs of pine and spruce hung heavy and wet, quietly dripping water to the sodden ground. Here and there, the drooping branches of maple, oak, and elm lifted whenever a breath of breeze relieved them of their heavy load of water, making it appear as if the trees were gently waving. The humid air dampened what the drizzle didn't reach, making everyone miserable. Beyond the standing water, Richard crouched again, studying the ground. Nikki couldn't imagine what he was looking for. None of the men waiting back under the tree appeared at all interested in revisiting the site of the pitched battle or seeing the dead. They were content to wait back where they were. Killing was unnatural and difficult for these men. They fought for what was right, and they did what they had to do, but they didn't relish it. That in itself spoke to their values. They had buried 3 of their own dead, but they had not buried the bodies of close to 100 soldiers who would have eagerly killed them had Richard not intervened. Nikki remembered her surprise the morning of the battle, coming upon Richard among all the dead and not at first understanding what had felled so many of them. Then she'd seen Richard slipping among those brutes, his sword moving with the fluid grace of a dance. It had been spellbinding to watch. With every thrust or slice a man died, there had been a thick swarm of the soldiers, many bewildered by seeing so many of their fellows crashing to the ground. Most had been burly young men who always dominated because of their muscle, the type who enjoyed intimidating people. The soldiers moved in jerks and fits, chopping and lurching at Richard, but they always seemed to strike just after he had already gone. His flowing movement didn't fit the blundering attack they were looking for. They began to fear that the spirits themselves had set upon them. In a way, perhaps they had. Still, their numbers were too great for one man, even if that one man was Richard, and he wielded the sword of truth. Just one of those ignorant, lumbering, brawny men connecting with a lucky swing of his axe would be all it took, or one arrow finding its mark. Richard was neither invincible nor immortal. Victor and the rest of his men had arrived just in time, a few moments before Nicky, too, made it to the scene. Victor's men had flown into the fray, drawing the attention away from Richard. Once Nicky arrived, she had ended it in a blinding flash as she unleashed her power against the soldiers still standing. Fearful of being exposed not only to the impending storm, but far more troubling, to potentially untold numbers of enemy soldiers who could appear on the scene at any moment, Nicky had instructed the men to carry Richard back through the woods to the secluded farmhouse. The most she had been able to do for him on that terrible race to cover had been to trickle a thread of her Han into him, hoping it would help keep him alive until she was able to do more. Nicky swallowed back the anguish of the ghastly memory. From a distance, she watched as Richard continued his meticulous inspection of the scene of the battle, ignoring the fallen soldiers, for the most part, and paying particular attention to the surrounding area. She couldn't imagine what he hoped to discover. As he searched, he had begun moving in a back-and-forth pattern, progressing steadily outward from the small clearing, circling the scene in ever-widening arcs. At times, he inched along the ground on all fours. By late in the morning, Richard had vanished into the woods. Victor finally tired of the silent vigil and marched through a bed of ferns nodding under the gentle fall of rain to where Nicky waited.
"What's going on?" he asked her in a low voice.
"He's looking for something."
"I can see that. I mean, what's going on with this business about a wife?"
Nicky let out a tired sigh.
"I don't know."
"But you have an idea."
Nicky spotted Richard briefly, moving among the trees some distance away.
"He was seriously wounded. People in that state sometimes suffer delirium."
"But he's healed now. He doesn't look or act feverish. He sounds normal enough and everything else, not like a person suffering visions and such. I've never seen Richard behave like this."
"Nor have I," Nicky admitted. She knew that Victor would never voice to her such concerns about Richard unless he was deeply worried. "I would suggest we try to be as understanding as possible of what he's gone through and see if he doesn't soon start to get his thoughts sorted out. He was unconscious for days. He's only been awake for a few hours. Let's give him some time to clear his head."
Victor considered her words before finally sighing and giving his nod of agreement. She was relieved that he didn't ask what they would do if Richard didn't soon get over his delirium. She saw Richard then, returning through the shadows and drizzle. Nicky and Victor crossed the field of battle to meet him. On the surface, his face seemed to show only stony intensity, but as well as she knew him, Nicky could read in his expression that something was seriously wrong. Richard brushed leaves, moss, and twigs from the knees of his trousers as he finally reached them.
"Victor, these soldiers weren't coming to take back Alterang."
Victor's eyebrows went up.
"They weren't?"
"No. They would need thousands of men for such a task, maybe tens of thousands. This many soldiers certainly weren't going to accomplish any such thing. And besides, if that was their intent, then what would be the point of slogging through the brush this far away from Alterang?" Victor made a sour face in admission that it had to be that Richard was right.
"Then what do you think they were doing?"
"It wasn't yet dawn when they were out here moving through the woods. That suggests to me that they might have been reconnoitering." Richard gestured off through the woods. "There's a road in that direction. We'd been using it to travel up from the south. I had thought we would be camped far enough off it for the night to avoid trouble. Obviously, I was wrong."
"We last heard that you were to the south," Victor said.
"The road makes for quicker traveling, so we were using the trails to cut cross-country so we could catch the road and take it south."
"It's an important road," Nicky added. It's one of the main arteries, one of the first that Jigang built. It allowed him to move soldiers swiftly. The roads he built enabled him to subdue all of the old world under the rule of the Imperial Order. Richard gazed off in the direction of the road almost as if he could see through the wall of trees and vines. Such a well-made road also allows him to move supplies. I think that's what was happening here. Being this close to Alter Rang, and being well aware of the revolt that had taken place there, they were probably concerned about the possibility of an attack as they passed through the area. Since these soldiers weren't massing for an attack on Alter Rang, I'd guess they had something more important going on, watching over supplies moving north for Jigang's army. He needs to crush the last of the resistance in the New World before the revolution at home burns his tail. Richard's gaze returned to Victor. I think these soldiers were reconnoitering, clearing the countryside in advance of a supply convoy. They were most likely scouting in the pre-dawn in the hopes of catching any insurgents asleep.
As we were.
Victor folded his muscular arms in obvious discontent.
We never expected there would be any soldiers out here in these woods. We were sleeping like babies. If you hadn't been here and intercepted them, they would have soon snuck up on us where we slept. Then we'd likely be the ones feeding the flies and ravens instead of them.
Everyone fell silent as they considered the might have been. Have you been hearing any news of supplies moving north? Richard asked.
Sure, Victor said. There's a lot of talk about large quantities of goods going north. Some convoys are accompanied by new troops being sent to the war. What you say about these men scouting for such a convoy makes sense.
Richard squatted down and pointed. See these tracks? These are a little more recent than the battle. It was a large contingent, most likely more soldiers who came looking for these dead men. This was as far as they came. These side ridges in the prints show where they turned around, here. It looks like they came in, spotted the dead soldiers, and left. You can see by their tracks as they left that they were in a hurry. Richard stood and rested his left hand on the pommel of his sword. Had you not taken me away right after the battle, these soldiers would have been on us. Fortunately, they went back rather than search the woods.
Why do you suppose that they would do that? Victor asked. Why would they see these men freshly killed and then leave?
They probably feared that a large force was lying in wait, so they rushed back to raise an alarm and ensure that the supply column was well protected. Since they didn't even take the time to bury their fellow soldiers, I'd guess that their most urgent concern was getting their convoy out of the area. Victor scowled at the tracks and then back in the direction of the dead soldiers.
Well,
he said as he ran his hand back over his head, wiping away beads of water.
At least we can take advantage of the situation. While Jigang is preoccupied with the war, that gives us time down here to work to knock support for the Order's rule right out from under them.
Richard shook his head. Jigang may be preoccupied with the war, but that won't stop him from moving to restore his authority back here. If there's one thing we've learned about the Dreamwalker, it's that he's methodical about annihilating any and all opposition.
Richard is right, Nikki said. It's a dangerous error to dismiss Jigang as a mere brute. While he is indeed brutal, he is also a highly intelligent individual and a brilliant tactician. He's had a lot of experience over the years. It's nearly impossible to goad him into acting impulsively. He can be bold when he has good reason to believe boldness will win the day. But he's more given to calculated campaigns. He acts out of firm convictions, not bruised pride. He's content to let you think you've won, to let you think whatever you want, for that matter, while he methodically plans how he will gut you. His patience is his most deadly quality. When he attacks, he is indifferent to how many casualties his army takes, as long as he knows he will have more than enough men left to win. But over the course of his career, until his campaign to take the New World anyway, he's tended to experience far fewer casualties than his enemies. That's because he holds no favor with naive notions of classic battle, of troops clashing on a field of honor. His way is usually to attack with such overwhelming numbers as to grind to dust the bones of his opposition. What his horde does to the vanquished is legend. For those in their path, the terror of the wait is unbearable. No sane person would want to be left alive to be captured by Jigang's men. For that reason, many welcome him with open arms, with blessings for their liberation, with supplications to be allowed to convert and join the order.
The only sound under the embracing shelter of the trees was the gentle patter of the light rain. Victor did not doubt her word. She had been witness to such events. At times, the knowledge that she had been a part of that perverted cause, that she had been a party to irrational beliefs that reduced men to nothing more than savages, made Nikki long for death. Certainly, she deserved no less. But she was now in the unique position of having the opportunity and ability to help reverse the success of the order. Setting matters right had become the cause that now drove her, sustained her, gave her purpose. "It's only a matter of time before Jigang moves to retake Altarang," Richard said into the silence. Victor nodded.
"Yes, if Jigang thought the revolution was confined to Altarang, then he would logically put all his efforts into taking back the city and being as ruthless about it as Nikki says. But we're making sure that doesn't happen."
He showed Richard a grim smile. "We're lighting fires in cities and towns wherever we can, wherever people are ready to cast off their chains. We're pumping the bellows and spreading the flames of rebellion and freedom far and wide so the Jigang can't confine and crush it."
"Don't fool yourself," Richard said. "Altarang is his home city. It's where the revolt against the order began. A popular uprising in the very city where Jigang was building his grand palace undermines everything the Imperial Order teaches. It was to be the city, the palace, from where Jigang and the high priests of the Fellowship of Order were for all time to rule over mankind in the name of the Creator. The people destroyed that palace and instead embraced freedom. Jigang will not allow such subversion of his authority to stand. He must crush the rebellion there if the Order is to survive to rule the old world and the new. It will be a matter of principled belief for him. He considers opposition to the ways of the Fellowship of Order to be blasphemy against the Creator. He will not be shy about throwing his most brutal and experienced soldiers into the task. He will want to make a bloody example of you. I'd expect such an attack sooner rather than later." Victor looked unsettled, but not entirely surprised.
"And don't forget," Nikki added, "the Brothers of the Fellowship of Order, who escaped, will be among those working to help reestablish the Order's authority. Such gifted men are no ordinary foe. We've hardly begun to root them out."
"All true enough, but you can't work iron to your will until you get it good and hot."
Victor tightened a defiant fist before them.
"At least we've begun to do what must be done."
Nikki conceded that much with a nod and a small smile to soften the dark picture she helped paint. She knew that Victor was right, that the task had to begin somewhere and at some point. He had already helped ring the hammer of freedom for a people who had all but given up hope. She just didn't want him to lose sight of the reality of the difficulty that lay ahead. Nikki would have been relieved to hear Richard dealing logically with the important matters at hand, but she knew better. When Richard locked onto something vital to him, he might address peripheral issues when necessary, but it would be a grave mistake to think that it diminished in the least his focus on his objective. In fact, he had delivered his warnings to Victor in swift summary. A mere matter to be gotten out of the way. She could see in his eyes that he was preoccupied with matters of far more importance to him. Richard finally turned his riveting gray eyes on Nikki. "You weren't with Victor and his men?" In a sudden flash of comprehension, Nikki realized why the matter of the soldiers and their supply convoy was important to him. It was a mere element of a greater equation. He was trying to unravel how and if the convoy figured into the illusion he still clung to. It was that calculation he was working to resolve.
"No," Nikki said. "We'd had no word, and didn't know what had happened to you. In my absence, Victor left to begin searching for you. Not long after, I returned to Altarang. I found out where Victor had gone and set out to join him. I was still some distance behind at the end of my second day of travel. so the third day I started out before dawn, hoping to catch up with him. I'd been traveling for almost 2 hours when I arrived nearby and heard the battle. I reached the fighting right at the end. Richard nodded thoughtfully.
I woke and Kalin was gone. Since we were close to Alter Rang, my first thought was that if I could find you, then maybe you could help me find Kalin. That's when I heard the soldiers coming through the woods.
Richard gestured up a rise. I heard them coming through those trees there. I had darkness on my side. They hadn't seen me yet, so I was able to surprise them.
Why didn't you hide? Victor asked.
More were coming down from that way, and others were coming in from that direction. I didn't know how many there were, but the way they were fanned out suggested to me that they were searching the woods. That made hiding risky. As long as there was any possibility that Kalin might be close and maybe hurt, I couldn't run. If I hid and waited until the soldiers had a chance to find me, then I would lose the element of surprise. Worse yet, dawn was approaching. Darkness and surprise worked to my advantage. With Kalin missing, I didn't have a moment to lose. If they had her, I had to stop them.
No one commented.
Richard turned to Kara next.
And where were you?
Kara blinked in surprise. She had to think a moment before she could answer.
I'm not exactly sure.
Richard frowned. You're not sure?
What do you remember?
I was on watch. I was checking some distance out from our camp. I guess something must have aroused my concern, and so I was making sure the area was clear.
I caught a whiff of smoke and was starting to investigate that when I heard the battle cries.
So you rushed back.
Kara idly pulled her braid forward over her shoulder. She looked to be having difficulty remembering clearly.
No.
She frowned in recollection.
No. I knew what was happening, that you were being attacked, because I heard the clash of steel and men dying. I had only just realized that it was Victor and his men camped off in that direction, that it was the smoke from their campfire I smelled. I knew that I was much closer to them than you, so I thought that the smartest thing to do would be to rouse them and bring their help with me.
Now that makes sense, Richard said.
He wearily wiped beads of rain from his face.
That's right, Victor said. Kara was right there close when I heard the clash of steel as well. I remember because I was lying awake in the quiet.
Richard's brow drew together. He looked up.
You were awake? Yes. The howl of a wolf woke me.
Chapter 5.
With sudden intensity, Richard leaned in a little toward the blacksmith.
You heard wolves howl? No,
Victor said as he frowned in recollection.
There was just one.
The three of them waited in silence as Richard stared off into the distance, as if he were mentally trying to fit together the pieces of some great puzzle.
Nikki glanced over her shoulder at the men back near the maple tree. Some yawned as they waited. Some had found seats on a fallen log. A few were engaged in hushed conversation. Others, arms folded, leaned against the trunks of trees and watched the surrounding woods as they waited.
It didn't happen this morning, Richard whispered to himself. When I was waking up this morning, when I was still half asleep, I was really remembering what happened the morning Kalin disappeared.
The morning of the battle, Nikki said softly in correction.
Lost in thought, Richard didn't appear to hear her correction.
I must have been remembering for some reason what happened back when I woke that morning.
He turned suddenly and seized her arm. A rooster crowed when I was being carried back to the farmhouse.
Surprised by his abrupt change of subject, and not knowing what he was getting at, Nikki shrugged.
I suppose it could have. I don't remember why.
There was no wind. I remember hearing the rooster crow and looking up and seeing motionless tree limbs above me. There was no wind at all. I remember how dead still it was.
You're right, Lord Rawl, Kara said. I remember when I ran into Victor's camp seeing the smoke from the fire going straight up because the air was dead calm. I think that was why we could hear the clash of steel and the cries from so far away, because there wasn't even a breath of breeze to cut the sound from carrying.
If it helps, the blacksmith said. There were a few chickens roaming around when we brought you to the farm. And you're right, there was a rooster, and it did crow. Matter of fact, we were trying not to be found so that Nikki could have the time to heal you, and I was afraid that the rooster might attract unwanted attention, so I told the men to cut its throat. After hearing Victor's account, Richard drifted back into thought. He tapped a finger against his lower lip as he considered yet another piece of his puzzle. Nikki thought he might have forgotten they were standing there. She leaned a little closer to him. "So?" He blinked and finally looked at her. "It had to be that when I woke today, I was really remembering that morning. Remembering for a reason. Sometimes you do that. Remember because there was some part of it that doesn't make sense. Remember for some reason." "What reason?" Nikki asked. "The wind. There was no wind that morning, but I remember that when I woke that morning, in the faint light of false dawn, I saw tree limbs moving, like in a breeze." Nikki was not just confused by his concern for wind, but worried for his state of mind. "Richard, you were asleep and just waking up. It was dark. You probably just thought you saw the tree branches moving."
"Maybe," was all he said.
"Maybe it was the soldiers coming," Kara offered.
"No," he said, dismissing her suggestion with an irritable wave of his hand. "That was a little later, after I'd discovered that Kaelin was missing." Seeing that neither Victor nor Kara was going to argue the point, Nikki decided to hold her tongue as well. Richard seemed to put the puzzle from his mind. He turned a deadly serious expression on the three of them. "Look, I have to show you all something, but you need to realize, despite how little you may be able to make out, that I know what I'm talking about. I don't expect you to take my word, but you need to understand that I have a lifetime of experience in this and routinely used such ability. I trust each of you in your area of expertise. This is mine. Don't close your minds to what I have to show you." Nikki, Kara, and Victor shared a look. With a nod to Richard, Victor set his reservations aside and turned to the men.
"You boys keep your eyes open now."
He circled a finger in the air.
"There could be soldiers about, so let's keep it quiet and stay alert. Farron, double-check the area."
The men nodded. Some came to their feet, apparently glad to have something to do other than just sit there, wet and cold. Four men set out through the trees to set up guard. Farron handed his pack and bedroll to one of the other men for safekeeping before knocking an arrow and slipping quietly into the brush. The young man was learning the trade of blacksmithing from Victor. Raised on a farm, he also had a natural talent for scouting unseen in the woods. He idolized Victor. Nikki knew that Victor was fond of the young man as well, but because he was fond of him, he was probably harder on him than on the other men. Victor had told her once, referring to his tough demands of his apprentice, that you had to pound the imperfections out of iron and work it hard if you wanted to shape it into something truly worthwhile. Since the battle, Victor had had sentries and lookouts on constant watch while Farron and several of the others scouted the surrounding forest. None of them had wanted to take any chance that enemy soldiers would unexpectedly come upon them while Nikki was trying to save Richard's life. After she had done all she could for Richard, Nikki had healed a nasty gash to one man's leg and taken care of a few other less serious wounds suffered by a half-dozen other men. Since the morning of the battle and Richard being hurt, she had gotten little sleep. She was exhausted. After watching the men set about the tasks assigned them, Victor clapped Richard on the shoulder.
"Show us, then."
Richard led Kara, Victor, and Nikki past the clearing with the dead men, and then off through the woods. He took a route between trees where the ground was more open. At the crest of a gentle rise, he stopped and crouched down. Seeing Richard on bended knee, his cloak draped over his back, his sword in a gleaming scabbard at his hip, his hood pushed back to expose strands of wet hair lying against his muscular neck, his bow and quiver strapped over his left shoulder, he looked at once regal, a warrior king, and at the same time like nothing so much as the wilderness guide from a distant land that he had once been. With intimate familiarity, his fingers brushed the pine needles, twigs, crumbles of leaves, bark, and loam. Nikki could sense, just by that touch, his breadth of understanding of the seemingly simple things spread out before him,
yet to him those things revealed another world. Richard remembered then his purpose and gestured, urging them to squat down close beside him. "Here," he said, pointing. "See this?" His fingers carefully traced a vague depression in the dense tangle of forest litter. "This is Kara's footprint."
"Well, that's no surprise," Kara said. "This is the way we came in from the road on our way to where we set up camp back there."
"That's right." Richard leaned out a little, pointing as he went on. "See here? And then off there? Those are more of your tracks, Kara. See how they come in here in a line showing where you were walking?"
Kara shrugged suspiciously.
"Sure." Richard moved to his right. They all followed. He again carefully traced a depression so they could make it out. Nicky couldn't see anything at all on the forest floor until he carefully drew the outline with a finger just above the ground. In doing so, he seemed to make the footprint magically appear for them. After he pointed it out, Nicky could tell what it was. "This is my track," he said, watching it as if fearing that were he to look away it might vanish. "The rain works to wear them down, some places more than others, but it hasn't made all of them disappear." With a finger and thumb, he carefully lifted a wet brown oak leaf from the center of the print. "Look, you can see under here how the pressure of my weight under the ball of my foot broke these small twigs. See? Rain can't obliterate things like that." He looked up at them to make sure they were all paying attention and then pointed off in the shadowy mist. "You can see my tracks coming in this direction toward us, just like Kara's." He stretched out and quickly traced two more vague depressions in the matted forest floor to show them what he meant. "See? You can still make them out."
"What's the point?" Victor asked.
Richard glanced back over his shoulder again before gesturing between the sets of tracks. "See the distance between Kara's tracks and mine? When we walked in here, I was on the left and Kara was to my right. See how far apart our tracks are?"
"What of it?" Nicky asked, as she pulled the hood of her cloak forward, trying to shield her face from the frigid drizzle. She pulled her hands back under the cloak and snugged them in her armpits for warmth.
"They're that far apart," Richard said, "because when we walked through here, Kalen was in the middle between us."
Nicky stared again at the ground. She was no expert, so she wasn't especially surprised that she couldn't see any other tracks. But this time, she didn't think that Richard could either.
"And can you show us Kalen's tracks?" she asked.
Richard turned a look on her of such intensity that it momentarily halted the breath she was about to take.
"That's the point."
He held up a finger with the same deliberate care with which he lifted his blade.
"Her tracks are gone. Not washed away by the rain, but gone. Gone as if they were never there."
Victor let out a very quiet and very troubled-sounding sigh. If she was shocked, Kara hid it well. Nicky knew that he hadn't told them all of what he had to say, so she remained guarded in her question.
"You're showing us that there are no tracks from this woman."
"That's right. I've searched. I found my tracks and Kara's tracks in various places, but where Kalen's tracks should be, there are none."
In the uncomfortable silence, no one wanted to say anything. Nicky finally took it upon herself to do so.
"Richard, you have to know why that is. Don't you see now? It's just your dream. There are no tracks because this woman doesn't exist."
With him here on his knees before her, looking up at her, it seemed she could see his soul laid bare in his gray eyes. She would have given nearly anything at that moment to be able to simply comfort him, but she couldn't do that. Nicky had to force herself to go on.
"You said yourself that you know about tracking, and yet even you can't find any tracks left by this woman. This should put the matter to rest. This should finally convince you that she just doesn't exist, that she never did exist."
She took a hand from under her cloak, from its warm resting place, and gently laid it on his shoulder in an effort to soften her words.
"You need to let it go, Richard."
He looked away from her eyes as he drew his lower lip through his teeth.
"It's not as simple a picture as you're painting it.
he said in a calm voice. I'm asking you all to look, just look, and try to understand the significance of what it is I'm showing you. Look at how far apart Kara and my tracks are. Can't you see that there was a third person there between us as we walked? Nikki wearily rubbed her eyes. Richard, people don't always walk close together. Maybe you and Kara were both looking around for any sign of threat as you walked through here. Or maybe you were both just tired and not paying attention. There could be any number of simple explanations as to why you two weren't walking closer together. When only two people walk together, they don't habitually walk this far apart. He pointed behind them. Look at the tracks we made coming over here. Kara again walked to my right. Look at how much closer together the tracks are. That's typical of two people walking side by side. You and Victor were behind us. Look at how close together your tracks are. These tracks are different. Can't you see by their nature that they're this far apart because there was another person walking between us? Richard. Nikki paused. She didn't want to argue. She was tempted to keep quiet and let him have his way, let him believe what he wanted to believe. And yet, silence would be feeding a lie, lending life to an illusion. While she ached for his difficulty and wanted to be on his side, she couldn't let him delude himself, or she would be causing him greater harm. He could never get better, never fully recover, until he faced the truth of the real world. Helping him see reality was the only way she could really help him. Richard, she said softly, trying to get that truth through to him without sounding harsh or condescending. Your tracks are there, and Kara's tracks are there. We can see that. You showed us. There are no others. You showed us that, too. If she was there between you and Kara, then why are her tracks not? They all hunched their shoulders in the wet and cold as they waited. Richard finally gathered his composure and spoke in a clear, firm voice. I think Kaylin's tracks were erased with magic. Magic? Kara asked, suddenly alert and ill-tempered. Yes, I think that whoever took Kaylin erased her tracks with magic. Nikki was dumbfounded and made no attempt to conceal it. Victor's gaze shifted back and forth between Nikki and Richard.
Can that be done?
Yes, Richard insisted. When I first met Kaylin, Darken Rall was after us. He was close on our trail. Zed, Kaylin, and I had to run. If Darken Rall had caught us, we would have been finished. Zed's a wizard, but he isn't as powerful as Darken Rall was, so Zed cast some magic dust back down the trail to hide our tracks. That has to be what happened here. Whoever took Kaylin covered their tracks with the use of magic. Victor and Kara glanced at Nikki for confirmation. As a blacksmith, Victor was not familiar with magic. Mord Sith didn't like magic and pointedly avoided the details of its workings. Their well-honed instinct was simply to violently eliminate anyone with magic if they posed even a potential threat to the Lord Rall. Both Victor and Kara waited to hear what Nikki had to say about the possibility of using magic to cover tracks. Nikki hesitated. Her being a sorceress didn't mean she knew everything there was to know about magic, but still. I suppose that such a use of magic is in theory possible, but I've never heard of it being done. Nikki made herself look into Richard's expectant gaze. I think the explanation of why there are no tracks is quite a bit simpler, and I think you know it, Richard. Richard couldn't mask his disappointment. Looking at this by itself and not being familiar with the nature of tracks and what they reveal, I'll grant that maybe it's hard to see what I'm saying. But this isn't all. I have something else to show you that may help you see the whole picture. Come on. Lord Rall, Kara said as she tucked a wet wisp of hair back under the hood of her dark cloak and avoided looking at him. Shouldn't we be getting on to other important matters? I have something important to show the three of you. Are you saying that you wish to wait here while I show Victor and Nikki? Her blue eyes turned up to him. Of course not. Fine, let's go. Without further protest, they followed him at a quick pace as he headed in a northerly direction, deeper into the woods. They tiptoed from rock to rock to cross a broad ravine with dark eddies of murky water flowing through it. When Nikki nearly slipped and fell, Richard took her hand and helped her across. His big hand was warm, but not feverish at least. She wished he would slow down and not stress his fragile health. The gentle slope on the far side revealed itself only by degree as they climbed higher through the drizzle and trailers of low clouds. To the left loomed the dark shadow of a rocky rise. Nikki could hear the burbling rush of water tumbling down that rise. As they went deeper into the swirling gray mist and dense green vegetation, huge birds lifted from their perches. Wings spread wide, the wary creatures silently glided away beyond sight. Harsh screeches of unseen animals echoed through the somber woods. With the mass of overlapping spruce and balsam boughs and the tangled dead limbs of ancient oaks draped with gossamer moss curtains, to say nothing of the gloomy drizzle, vines and dense tangle of saplings struggling to reach up for the elusive light, it was not easy to see very far. Only lower to the forest floor where the sunlight rarely reached was it more open. Farther into the sodden forest, dark trunks of trees stood clear of the brush and thick foliage like sentinels watching the three people move among their gathered army. The ground where Richard took them was easier traveling since it was more open and covered with soft, sprawling mats of pine needles. Nikki imagined that even on the sunniest of days, only thin streamers of sunlight ever penetrated all the way down to the forest floor. Off to the sides, here and there, she saw nearly impenetrable tangles of brush and tightly knitted walls of young conifers. The expanse under the towering pines made a natural but unmarked pathway. At last, Richard halted, lifting his arms out to his side so that they wouldn't step out past him. Spread out before them was more of the same, sparse growth sprouting among the thick bed of brown needles. Following his direction, they squatted down beside him. Richard gestured over his right shoulder. Back that way is where Kara, Kalin, and I came in on the night we camped, by where the battle took place. In various places around our camp are my tracks from when I stood second watch and Kara's tracks from third watch. Kalin had first watch that night. There are no tracks from her watch. His glance to each of them in turn was a silent request to hear him out before they started arguing. Back that way, he said, pointing as he went on, was where the soldiers were coming up through the woods. From over in that direction, Victor, you and your men came to join the battle. In nearly the same place are your tracks from when you carried me back to the farmhouse. Off that way, where I already showed you, are the tracks of other soldiers who came in and found their fellow soldiers dead. None of us or any of the soldiers has been up this way. Here, where we are now, there are no tracks. Look around. You'll see only my fresh tracks from this morning when I was searching. Other than that, there are no footprints from anyone else coming through here. In fact, there's no sign that anyone has ever been here. At least it would appear that no one has ever been here before. Victor idly rubbed his thumb on the steel shaft of the mace hanging from his belt.
But you think otherwise?
Yes, even though there are no tracks, someone did come this way, and they left evidence. Richard leaned out and with one finger touched a smooth rock about the size of a loaf of bread. As they hurried past, they stumbled on this rock. Victor seemed caught up in the story.
How can you tell?
Look carefully at the markings on the rock. As Victor leaned in a bit, Richard pointed. See here? The way the top of the rock, where it was exposed to the air and weather, has the pale tannish yellow discoloration of lichen and such? And here, like the hull of a boat below the waterline, you can see the dark brown rime that shows where the belly of the rock had been lying beneath the ground. But it's not lying that way now. It's not settled into its socket in the ground, its recent resting place. It's now lifted a little out of that socket and turned partway over. See how a section of the dark bottom is now exposed? Were it out of the ground for longer, the dark color would have been worn away and the lichen would begin to grow there too. But it hasn't had that much time yet. This is recent. Richard waggled his finger back and forth.
Look at the ground, here on this side of the rock. You can see the socket where the rock originally rested, but now the rock has been shoved back a little, leaving a void between this side of the rock and the wall of the cavity. On the back side, away from us, because the rock was recently disturbed, you can still see a ridge of dirt and debris that has been pushed up. The open socket on this side and the ridge on the far side shows that whoever stumbled on this rock and disturbed it was moving away from our camp, going north.
But then where's their trail? Victor asked. Their footprints.
Richard raked back his wet hair. The trail has been erased with magic. I searched. There is no trail. Look at the rock. It's been disturbed, kicked partway out of its resting place in the ground. But there is no scuff mark on it. While the rock wasn't moved much, it was moved. A boot grazing this rock enough to move it like this would have to leave a mark. Yet there is no mark, just as there are no other footprints. Nikki pushed her hood back. You're twisting everything you find around to fit what you want to believe, Richard. You can't have it both ways. If magic was used to erase their trail, then why is it that you are able to detect their trail by this rock? Probably because the magic they used erases footprints. The person who used that magic must not know a great deal about tracks or tracking. I don't think they're very familiar with the outdoors. When they used magic to erase their footprints, they probably never gave any thought to putting disturbed stones back in place. Richard, surely look around, he said as he swept his arm out. Look at how perfect the forest floor is.
What do you mean?
Victor asked. It's too perfect. Twigs, leaves, bark are too evenly distributed. Nature is more erratic. Victor, Nikki, and Kara peered at the ground. Nikki saw only a normal-looking forest floor. Here and there, small things, pine seedlings, spindly weeds, and oak sapling with only three big leaves, sprouted up through the litter of twigs, moss, bark, and fallen leaves sprinkled over the bed of pine needles. She didn't know all that much about tracks or tracking, or forests, for that matter. Richard always left blazes on trees when he wanted her to be able to find and follow his trail. But it didn't look like anyone had been through the place, nor did it look overly perfect, as Richard suggested. As she looked around, it appeared the same as other places she eyed for comparison. Victor and Kara seemed equally confounded. Richard, Nikki said with strained patience, I'm sure there could be any number of explanations as to why a rock looks disturbed to you. For all I know, it could be disturbed, as you suggest. But maybe an elk or a deer kicked it as they went by, and over time their tracks have been worn away. Richard was shaking his head. No, look at the socket. It's still well formed. You can read by how much the edges have degraded that it happened only a few days ago. Time, especially in the rain, erodes such edges and works to fill in the gap. Any deer or elk kicking this rock would have left tracks that would be just as recent. Not only that, but a hoof would have scuffed it, the same as a boot. I'm telling you, 3 days ago, someone stumbled on this rock. Nikki gestured. Well, that dead branch over there could have fallen on it and disturbed it. If it did, then the lichen growing on the rock would show the scar of the impact, and the branch would show evidence that it had hit something hard. It doesn't. I've already looked. Kara threw her hands up. Maybe a squirrel jumped from a tree and landed on it. Not nearly heavy enough to have moved this rock, Richard said. Nikki drew a weary breath. So what you're saying is that the fact that there are no tracks from this woman, Kaylin, proves that she exists. No, that's not what I'm saying. Not the way you're putting it, anyway. But it does confirm it if you look at everything together, if you put it all into context. Nikki's hands fisted at her sides. There were important matters that had to be addressed. They were running out of time. Instead of dealing with urgent matters in need of their attention, they were out in the middle of the woods looking at a rock. She could feel the blood going to her face. That's ridiculous. All you've shown us, Richard, is proof that this woman you imagined is just that, imagined. She doesn't exist. She left no tracks because you only dreamed her. There's nothing mysterious about it. It's not magic. It's simply a dream.
Richard abruptly rose up before her. He changed in a heartbeat from a man of calm intensity to a figure of heart-stopping presence, power, and awakening anger. But rather than confront her, he took a step past her, back toward the way they'd come from, and stopped. Still and tense, Richard stared back through the woods. "Something's wrong," he said in low warning. Kara's Ajeel spun up into her fist. Victor's brow tightened as his fingers found the mace hanging from his belt. In the distance, back through the dripping forest, Nikki heard the sudden, wild alarm cries of ravens. The cries that came next reminded her of nothing so much as the sounds of bloody murder. Chapter 6. Richard bounded back through the woods, back toward the waiting men, back toward the screams. He raced headlong through a blur of trees, branches, brush, ferns, and vines. He leaped over the rotting logs and used a well-planted boot to bound over a boulder. He dodged his way through stands of young pines and a cluster of flowering dogwood. Without slowing, he batted aside tamarack limbs and ducked under balsam boughs. Nets of dead branches on the lower trunks of young spruce trees snatched at his clothes as he charged past. More than once, dead limbs jutting out spear-like from larger trees nearly impaled him before he sidestepped at the last instant. Running at such a reckless speed through dense woods, let alone in the rain, was treacherous. It was hard to recognize hazards in time to avoid them. Any one of a number of protruding branches could easily gouge out an eye. One slip on wet leaves or moss or rocks could cause a skull-splitting tumble. Driving a foot down into a crevice or fissure at a dead run would likely shatter a leg. Richard had once known a young man who had done just that. His broken leg and ankle never mended right, leaving him partially crippled for life. Richard focused his concentration on his intended path, taking as much care as possible without slowing. He dared not slow. The whole way as he ran, he heard the terrible screams and cries, the shrieks and the sickening snapping sounds. He could also hear Kara, Victor, and Nikki crashing through the brush behind him. He didn't wait for them to catch up. Every long stride, every leap took him farther out ahead of them. Running as fast as he could, gasping for air, Richard was surprised to find himself winded before he should have been. At first disconcerted, he then remembered the reason. Nikki had said that he wasn't yet recovered, and because he had lost a lot of blood, he would need rest to gain back his strength. He kept running. He would have to make do with what strength he had. It wasn't that much farther. More than that, though, he kept running because the men needed help. These were men who had come to his aid when he had been in trouble. He didn't know what was happening, but it was clear to Richard that they were in some kind of peril. On the morning of the attack, if he'd known more about how to call upon his gift, he might have been able to use that ability to stop the soldiers before Victor and his men had arrived. Had he been able to do that, three of those men would not have died in the fighting. Of course, had Richard not been where he was and taken action to stop the soldiers, then Victor and his men might well have all ended up murdered at their camp, most while they slept. Richard couldn't help feeling that he might have done more. He didn't want to see any of these men hurt. He kept running with all his strength, holding back nothing. He would use whatever strength he had. He could gain back his strength. Lives could not be gotten back. There were times like this when he wished that he knew more about how to call upon his gift, but his ability regrettably worked differently than in others. Instead of functioning through cognizant direction, as Nikki's power did, Richard's ability worked through anger and need. The morning that the Imperial Order soldiers had poured in all around him, he had drawn his sword for the purpose of his survival, and in so doing, had given his anger over to the weapon. Unlike his own gift, he knew that he could count on the power of his sword. Others with the gift learned to use their ability from a young age. Richard never had. It had been an upbringing of peace and security that had given him a chance at life, at growing up to profoundly value life. The drawback was that such an upbringing had also left him unaware of and ignorant of his own talent. Now that Richard was grown, though, learning to use his latent ability was proving more than difficult, not only because of his upbringing, but because his particular form of the gift was so extraordinarily rare. Neither Zed nor the Sisters of the Light had had any success at all in teaching him how to consciously direct his power. He knew little more than what Nathanrael, the prophet, had told him, that his power was most often sparked through anger and a particular specific kind of desperate need, which Richard had not been able to identify or isolate. As far as he had been able to determine, the character of the need required to ignite his power was unique to each circumstance. Richard also knew that using magic did not involve whim. No amount of wishing or straining could ever produce results. The initiation and use of magic required specific conditions. He just didn't understand how to produce or provide those conditions. Even wizards of great ability sometimes had to use books to ensure that they got the details right if the specific magic they wanted was to work. At a young age, Richard had memorized one of those books, the Book of Counted Shadows. That was the book which Darkenrall had been hunting for after he had put the boxes of Orden in play. On the morning Kaelin had vanished to meet the threat of the seemingly endless ranks of soldiers charging in upon him, Richard had had to depend on his sword and not his own innate powers. The frenzied fighting had taken him to the brink of exhaustion. At the same time, his worry for Kaelin left him distracted to the point where his mind wasn't fully on the fight. He knew that allowing such a diversion to beguile his attention was dangerous and foolish. But it was Kaelin. He had been helplessly worried for her. Had his need not summoned his gift when it did, the hail of arrows suddenly showering in at him would have been fatal a few dozen times over. He hadn't seen the bolt fired from a crossbow. As it shot for his heart, he only recognized the threat the last possible instant, and because of the crucial need to also stop the three soldiers lunging for him at the same time, he'd only been able to deflect the path of the arrow's flight, not stop it. It seemed like he'd already gone over the memory 1,000 times and come up with any number of could-haves and should-haves that, in his mind's harsh judgment, would have prevented what had happened. As Nicky had said, though, he was not invincible. As he plunged through the woods, the forest unexpectedly fell silent. The echoing screams died away. The misty green wilderness was again left to the muted whisper of the light rain falling through the leafy canopy. In the outwardly peaceful and once again quiet world around him, it almost seemed as if he had only imagined the terrible sounds he'd heard. Despite his fatigue, Richard didn't slow. As he ran, he listened for any sign of the men, but he could hear little more than his own labored breathing, his heartbeat pounding in his ears, and his swift footfalls. Occasionally, he also heard branches behind him breaking as the other three tried to catch up with him, but they were still falling farther behind. For some reason, the eerie calm was somehow more frightening than the screams had been. What had started out sounding like the raven's hoarse croaks rising into the kinds of terrified cries an animal makes only when it's being killed had somewhere along the line begun to sound human. And now there was only the menacing silence. Richard tried to convince himself that he had only imagined that the screams had turned human. As chilling as such cries had been, it was the haunting, unnatural stillness after they'd ended that made goose flesh prickle the hair at the back of his neck. Just before he reached the brink of the clearing, Richard finally drew his sword. The singular sound of freeing the blade sent the cutting ring of steel through the damp woodland, ending the silence. Instantly, the heat of the sword's anger flooded through every fiber of his being to be answered in kind by his own anger. Once again, Richard committed himself to the magic he knew and upon which he could depend. Filled with the sword's power, he ached for the source of the threat and lusted to end it. There had been a time when fear and uncertainty made him reluctant to surrender to the rising storm brought forth from the ancient wizard-wrought blade, hesitant to answer the call with his own anger, but he had long since learned to let himself go into the rapture of the rage. It was that righteous wrath that he had learned to bend to his will. It was that power he directed to his purpose. There had been those in the past who'd coveted the sword's power, but in their blind lust for that which belonged to others, had ignored the darker perils they stirred by using such a weapon. Instead of being masters of the magic, they had become servants to the blade, to its anger, and to their own rapacious greed. There had been those who had used the power of the weapon for evil ends. Such was not the fault of the blade. The use of the sword, for good or for evil, was the conscious choice made by the person wielding it, and all responsibility fell to them. Racing through the wall of tree limbs, shrubs, and vines, Richard came to a halt at the edge of the clearing where the soldiers had fallen in the battle several days before. Sword in hand, he gasped for air, despite how putrid the air smelled, struggling to catch his breath. At first, as he scanned the bizarre scene spread out before him, he had trouble comprehending what it was he was seeing. Dead ravens lay everywhere. Not just dead, but ripped apart. Wings, heads, and parts of carcasses littered the clearing. Feathers by the thousands had settled like black snow over the rotting corpses of the soldiers. Frozen in shock for only an instant, and still breathless, Richard knew that this was not what he sought. Tearing across the battle site, he bounded up the short bank, through the gaps in the trees and over trampled vegetation toward where the men had been waiting. The rage of the sword spiraled up through him as he ran, making him forget that he was tired, that he was winded, that he wasn't yet fully recovered, preparing him for the fight to come. In that moment, the only thing that mattered to Richard was getting to the men, or more precisely, getting at the threat to the men. There was a matchless rapture in killing those who served evil. Evil unchallenged was evil sanctioned. Destroying evil was really a celebration of the value of life made real by destroying those who existed to deny others their life. Therein lay the fundamental purpose behind the sword's essential, indispensable requirement for rage. Rage blunted the horror of killing, stripped away the natural reluctance to kill, leaving only its naked necessity if there was to be true justice. As Richard raced out of the stand of birch, the first thing that caught his attention was the maple tree where the men had been waiting. The lower limbs had been stripped bare of leaves. It looked like a storm had swooped down to rip through the woods. Where only a short time ago small trees grew, now all that was left was shattered stumps. Branches thick with shimmering wet leaves or pine needles lay scattered about. Huge, jagged splinters of tree trunks stuck up from the ground like spent spears after a battle. Beneath the maple, scattered across the forest floor, was a scene that, at first, Richard could make no sense of. Nearly everything that before had been some shade of green, whether dusty sage, yellowish, or rich emerald, was now tainted with the stain of red. Richard stood panting, his heart pounding, fighting to focus the rage on a threat he could not identify. He scanned the shadows and darkness back among the trees, looking for any movement. At the same time, he struggled to sort out the confusion of what he was seeing on the ground before him. Kara skidded to a halt to his left, ready for a fight. An instant later, Victor stumbled to a stop on his right, his mace held in a tight fist. Nikki raced in right behind, no weapon evident, but Richard could sense the air around her virtually crackling with her power, ready to be unleashed.
"Dear spirits," the blacksmith whispered.
His six-bladed mace, a deadly weapon the man had made himself, rose in his fist as he cautiously started forward. Richard lifted his sword in front of Victor to bar him from going any farther. His chest against the blade, the blacksmith reluctantly heeded the silent command and stopped. What, at first, had been a bewildering sight became at last all too clear. A man's forearm, missing the hand but still covered with a brown flannel shirt sleeve, lay in a bed of ferns at Richard's feet. Not far away stood a heavy laced boot with a jagged white shin bone stripped of sinew and muscle jutting out from the top. In a thicket of rough-leafed dogwood just to the side lay a section of a torso, its flesh torn away to lay bare a section of the spine and blanched rib bones. Squiggles of pink viscera lay strewn over the log where the men had been sitting. Ragged pieces of scalp and skin lay atop bare rock and scattered everywhere through the grass and bushes. Richard could not imagine what power could have caused such a shocking scene. A thought struck him. He glanced back over his shoulder at Nikki.
Sisters of the Dark?
Nikki slowly shook her head as she studied the carnage. There are a few similar characteristics, but on balance, this is nothing like the way they kill. Richard didn't know if that was comforting news or not. Slowly, carefully, he stepped forward among the still bleeding remains. It didn't look to him like it had been a battle. There were no cuts from swords or axes, no arrows or spears to mark the battlefield. None of the limbs or mangled ribbons of muscle appeared to have been cut. Every piece looked as if it had been torn away from where it belonged. It was so horrific a sight, so incomprehensible, that it was beyond sickening. Richard found it disorienting, trying to conceive of what could have created such devastation, not just of the men, but of the landscape where they had been. From somewhere beyond the boiling rage of the sword's magic, he felt an agony of sorrow for what he had not been able to stop, and he knew that the sorrow would only grow. But right then, he wanted nothing so much as to get his hands on whoever or whatever had done this.
"Richard," Nikki whispered from close behind, "I think it best if we get out of here."
The direct, calm tone of her voice could not have been any more compelling a warning. Filling with rage from the sword in his fist and his own impassioned anger at what he was seeing, he ignored her. If there was anyone left alive, he had to find them.
This is the end of disc number 2. Please insert disc number 3.